to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 427. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois, and we're back with another Voss Group, Voss Group number 25. And that means, of course, that I have with me Dr. Lane Tipton, who teaches biblical and systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary out in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to have you with us.
Camden, as always, great to be back.
We're so happy to be doing these Voss Groups episodes, one a month. We've been going at it for a while, and we're thankful for your contribution, Lane, and willingness to do this, but we have to trust such tremendous support out there. We're looking forward to diving in and getting into pages 121 through 124 today, looking specifically at the Bereath made between Jehovah and Israel. So there's an awful lot to speak about in terms of covenant theology and the particulars of Exodus 19 and 24, and also how that sets the stage for future biblical revelation. So that's where we're headed today. So you can queue up those texts and queue up Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments, to page 121 in the Banner of Truth edition. We're in the period of Mosaic Revelation. For those of you who might have an old first edition, the heading there, point to the Bereath made between Jehovah and Israel, which is, if I flip back here, chapter 8. There we are. So you can find that heading and follow along with us. Before we get into that, though, I have a couple things to mention. The first, most important and pressing, is that we are having our regional theology conference in Austin, Texas, April 30th, 2016. So if you will visit us online at reformedforum.org/conference, you can find information about all of this. We have scheduled Lane to speak. I'll be speaking. Jim Cassidy will be speaking as well. Glenn Clary will be there and involved. And we're looking forward to some wonderful things. Saturday, April 30th, 2016, planning to have plenary addresses and also a live recording of a Christ the Center episode. Second thing in the morning that day. So if you're interested and able to come, check us out, reformedforum.org/conference, and we'll see here that there's information on where to head. We're going to be in Austin, Texas, specifically in Pflugerville, Texas, and looking forward to having you down there. While you're on the website, we also want you to visit our donate page. If you're able, at the top right of the page, you can click on that and find information about how to pledge your support here at Reformed Forum. We have various online giving opportunities. You can also customize giving with monthly gifts or any specific one-time gift. You can also, of course, mail a check. We got a P.O. box that our good friend Jeff Waddington checks regularly. And we're at Reformed Forum at P.O. Box 27422, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19118, for those of you that still know what the post office does. That being said, there's an awful lot on the website, not just ways to help, but more importantly, ways that we can help you, and you can do so by checking into the archives. A while ago, I put on the right side of the homepage a list of key episodes, and you'll see a whole bunch of older episodes that we've done, some going back all the way to August 2008. We have an old episode there on the eschatological views of the Westminster Divines. Lane, do you happen to remember that episode? And do you know who our plenary speaker was for that one?
That would be the Reverend Dr. Jeffrey K. Jew.
Yes.
Yeah, Jeff Jew, Dr. Jew.
That was a while ago. That was a couple of locales ago. It was in my first apartment when my wife and I moved to Philadelphia. So that was a fun episode. We also have one here with Daryl Hart on Deconstructing Evangelicalism. That was recorded the same place. Got one on the Clark Van Til controversy. Got one on Baptism, Covenant, and Election. That was with you and Dr. Gaffin. That was an excellent episode. One on Roman Catholic theology and practice. Glenn Clary did one on the regulative principle of worship. So, you know, we handpicked several of these key episodes and put them there on the homepage. And that's just a brief window into the vast archives of resources that we did not too long ago. So it's beginning in 2008, we were able to start putting together these episodes, putting them online, and we haven't taken anything down. They're all there. So if you can dig around through the archives, you can use a search function, find things that might be relevant to some questions that you have or some areas that you'd like to explore further. It's all online, and it's all available for free, reformedforum.org. Well, Lane, continuing now our discussion on Voss, we come to a very important section here when we're speaking about revelation in the period of Moses. We certainly think of Moses as an intercessor between God and his people, and we can't think too much about God's people without thinking about his specific relationship to them. And God has expressed that to us by way of covenant. As we come upon the heading here at the bottom of page 121 in the current edition, the Banner of Truth edition, the Berith, or Berit, depending if you spirantize your Tavs, made between Jehovah and Israel. Why is this covenant so significant, not just in general, but specifically here in the period of Revelation during Moses' time?
Well, one thing this helps us do is remember the progressive and organic character of redemptive revelation. Mm-hmm. It really does help us do that. And I think just to make a kind of global comment before we dive into any of the details, this covenant that the Lord is entering into with his people, this is an organic extension of and preliminary fulfillment of the promises that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to the patriarchs. If you remember, when we set this in the broader context of the Exodus, the Lord hears the groaning of his people, the end of Exodus 2, and he remembers the promises that were made to the patriarchs. And so the point that Voss wants us to appreciate here, and the point that I think needs as much emphasis as we're able to give, is that we're dealing with an intensive, preliminary, we could call it typological fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant of grace.
Yeah.
And it's a useful thing to remember, because it's tempting to try to think of the, and there are some very unique features, by the way, to the Mosaic covenant that are not included in the Abrahamic covenant. Unique administrative features of this covenant come into view.
Right.
But it's important to recognize that the about the last thing we can say about this covenant, the last thing we should say, is that it's some kind of graceless repristination of the pre-fall covenant made mm-hmm. with Adam. And so just as an overarching frame of reference here, we're looking at the history of special revelation and the organic progressive dimensions of the Abrahamic promise coming to a kind of penultimate or typological fulfillment in the Mosaic covenant. And so it's a very important thing to keep in mind. And it's in that context, I think, that we best approach the Exodus out of Egypt and the ratification of this covenant relationship forged in that Exodus event in Exodus 24.
You know, that's important, especially as we distinguish covenant theology from dispensationalism, for instance. How would initially just the cursory features and points that you've made, we'll dive down further in detail, but how on a cursory level does what you just said differ from how a dispensationalist might approach the era of revelation under Moses?
Well, this would be a dispensation of law, which would offer, in terms of its original or early versions, classical dispensationalism, the law would offer a separate way of salvation for perfect and personal obedience. Mm-hmm. And so you get a kind of hard, absolute, categorical, or put it this way, substantial distinction between grace and works. You can also find with a different set of concerns in view, you can also find within the Lutheran tradition the idea that there is a substantial republication mm-hmm. of a graceless works principle in the Mosaic covenant at some point, whether it's the whole of the covenant or whether it might get applied in a more nuanced way. And so what this helps us recognize is that no matter what we're going to say about the administrative uniqueness of the Mosaic covenant, we're going to see here, I think, from Voss, that there's just no way to get around it being an administration of a covenant of grace in baseline continuity with the Abrahamic at the individual and corporate level. It's just not useful to try to formulate differently. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, we're going to see some administrative distinctiveness to the Mosaic, but it's not a covenant that is different in kind.
Uh-huh.
Different substantially from the previous covenant. And classical dispensationalism, particularly the Schofield variety, would say, well, it is. It's offering salvation by works. And that would be the most bald, mm-hmm. the most unqualified, the most unnuanced, the most basic form of error that we would need to avoid. And I think
That's largely died away. I mean, in terms of people who would typically call themselves dispensationalists now, wouldn't they? I mean, it seems in my estimation, in my interactions with people, that they've continually progressed and move toward features of covenant theology, although wouldn't necessarily call themselves covenant theologians. I mean, you have guys with the Gentry and Wellham volume, Kingdom Through Covenant, this notion of progressive covenantalism. And even in people who aren't trying to relabel themselves, I think classic dispensationalism has started to erode and move away. They're still holding on to certain elements or aspects of it, but some of the more, I don't know, egregious errors they've been demonstrated as untenable biblically.
Yeah, the Israel church distinction is the thing that defines right. the dispensationalist schema, the separate but parallel destinies of the people of God. And if you get to the point where you modify that, you're really about to just leave dispensationalism. And I think one of the things that just intuitively the progressive modified versions of dispensationalism from Bach to Wellham and company – it's that they know instinctively that after the fall, no sinner can be saved by works mm-hmm. wholly apart from grace. They know intuitively that the person's work who underwrites and secures our salvation is Christ alone.
Amen.
It's not the sinner himself or herself. So yeah, that's true. But we have to recognize that in the back of all of the Israel church distinction was a hard line distinction between law and promise, mm-hmm. law and grace, and that you probably get it most programmatically in that early version of classical dispensationalism.
You do.
And so Voss is helping us here, I think, just keep clear that no matter what the distinctive features of the administration of the Mosaic covenant are, it's within an administration of a covenant of grace that we want to locate those distinctive features and even the unique typical significance of the nation of Israel, because it's definitely present here, which we'll probably be talking about next time.
It is odd, and it's a very formal level or a cursory level where you do find some similarities between classic dispensationalism and a certain version of or form of Lutheranism. And that might be very surprising and unsettling to some people, but we hope to clarify some things like that. And again, I don't want to ruffle too many feathers, but at least at a formal or classical level, you do see that in the way that they treat this Mosaic period. What are some of the texts here that are right in front of us that are important for us to look
at? Well, Voss wants us to note, and Camden, you might, if you have a Bible nearby, might be able to read Exodus 19:5, mm-hmm. Exodus 19:8, and Exodus 24:3, which brings into view the fact that the covenant, the Berit or the Berith, is placed before the people, and their assent is required.
Yeah, we'll that's the
that. If you could read that. Yeah,
we'll yeah. 19:5 says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine." 19:8 says, "All the people answered together and said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do.' And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord." And then what, 24:3? 24:3 is Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So there's some features here that obviously are similar and in line with the covenantal developments to this point. But some of these verses indicate that there's something different going on.
Yeah. What we could say in terms of just an overarching guide for this before we get into the differences of nuance is that this covenant is unilaterally established by God, but is definitely bilateral in its outworking. He argues that on the very top of page 122 that the initiative in designing the terms is something, and imposing the terms is something exclusively done by Jehovah. No parleying, no cooperation between God and man in determining the nature and content are conceivable. So this is a unilaterally, sovereignly administered covenant. But at the same time, it's bilateral in its outworking, meaning that it is something received and something into which Israel enters in a self-conscious act of communion with the Lord. But the point that stands out here, and this is what Voss notes, is that it's not because of it being unilateral, bilateral, sovereignly established, anything else, that it's called a covenant. He says what's to be emphasized here is the voluntary acceptance of the covenant by the people. And he says that it's the voluntary character where the people hear the covenant read and then say, all that we have heard, we will do. That is not something that you find explicitly present, for instance, in the Abrahamic covenant.
Yeah.
Now, what you do have is the Lord saying to Abraham in Genesis 17, walk before me and be blameless and be sure to keep the covenant of circumcision that I've made with you. Now, does Abraham say, or the whole of his seed with him, say, all that you have said, Lord, we will do? No, but there's definitely a sense in which there is that mutuality, that bilateral conditional dimension of the covenant of grace is clearly present in Genesis 17. But what differs here, I think, and Camden, you may want to comment on this, but what differs here is that it's a kind of formal corporate feature that comes into view. It's not just that Abraham, as the father of a new humanity, with a covenant unilaterally established by God in Genesis 15, undertakes to obey the Lord, to be blameless, to fulfill his obligations in the covenant of circumcision by circumcising his household. It's that in this arrangement, there is a corporate, open, public declaration and voluntary acceptance of this covenant as it brings into view the nation as a whole. Mm-hmm. I think that's what Voss is getting at, that you've got something of a more explicit voluntary acceptance at the corporate level that you just don't see in an explicit, direct way previously.
Yeah, that's a helpful way to think about it, and something interesting here, because some people would see that the differences are too big and of a nature that they must disconnect it somehow. Yes. From what was going on with the Abrahamic covenant. And specifically in Genesis 15, you do find Abraham completely incapacitated. I mean, he's unconscious during the enactment of this covenant ceremony. He's put out.
Yeah.
But then we do find elements in Genesis 17, but also certainly in Genesis 22, which seem to indicate that there's more there than what we are initially given explicitly in Genesis 15, which certainly doesn't necessitate that it was absent in Genesis 15. We just aren't given necessarily all of the Lord develops it further throughout Abraham's life.
Well, he does. And the thing that I think we need to appreciate here is that it's not right to say that the Abrahamic covenant is absolutely and without qualification, unilaterally established and unconditional.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Why? Because there is clearly, and when Genesis 15 and Genesis 17 are read together, there is a unilateral establishment, a sovereign establishment of that covenant by the Lord, where Abram is incapacitated, especially in 7 through 21. But there is also a commandment of the Lord for him to walk before the Lord, Abraham, and be blameless before the Lord, and to fulfill the terms of the covenant of circumcision. And failure to do so is something that in Genesis 17 results in a judgment that's impending upon Abraham for failing to do so. Right? So that you clearly get a covenant that is unilaterally and sovereignly established by the Lord, a covenant of grace. It's bilateral in its outworking. It has a conditional feature built into it. And so the very fact that there is a bilateral and conditional character to the Mosaic covenant does not mean it is substantially a different kind of covenant from the Abrahamic. But what starts to come into view, in fact, let me put it this way. No Israelite, likened to Abraham, sheds his own blood in the inauguration of this covenant. Animal blood is shed just as it was shed in the passing between the pieces with Abram.
Uh-huh.
And likewise here, there is a sovereignly supplied sacrificial substitute and a sprinkling of that blood upon the people, showing that this is a sovereign blood-bought, this is a sovereign God who is sprinkling a blood-bought people in a redemptive bond. But what you do have here, and we probably won't get to this in detail this week, Camden, because we're going to talk about something else, is this, that the voluntary character of this covenant has a national dimension that is going to be tethered to land retention.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be. See, it's not that it's a separate covenant, a substantially distinct covenant from the Abrahamic covenant of grace. It's that it's going to have a unique typological layer at the national level. And it's going to be something where Israel's obedience or lack thereof will be the feature that determines whether or not the typical maintenance, the typical land inheritance is maintained. If they obey, it will be Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28. If they don't obey, it will be lost. Mm-hmm. And so that covenant has, at the level of its administration, it can be broken and the entire typical inheritance lost. See, that's where I think the uniqueness of the administration lies. So it's not necessarily that when this oath is sworn by the people and there's this voluntary dimension to all that we have heard we will do, it's not that the obligation or even voluntary submission to the terms of the covenant is categorically, fundamentally, essentially, or substantially distinct from the Abrahamic. It's that you're going to have a national typical layer that is present here that has a very distinct pedagogical purpose, whereby Israel is going to, at the end of the day, is going to reenact the sin and the exile of a protological son.
Precisely.
That's down the road. I hope the listeners don't get too frustrated, but that's a preview maybe of some things that we can talk about later. But
certainly, but I mean that certainly explains or gives at least a template or schematic for consideration, so that people can see where we're headed and how we will develop this in the future. But you can see then, though, that at the national level, there can be a replication or a rehearsal, a reenactment of the sin, fall, and exile of Adam, the protological son, now Israel, the nation, acting as the typological son. We see them eventually fail in the way that Adam did, and then they were exiled from the holy realm, just like Adam was exiled from Eden, sent away. Yeah. It couldn't be in the presence of God in that sense. But it certainly doesn't kill or destroy the promises given in and through Abraham. Ultimately, the promise is given to the seed of the woman, Jesus Christ, who serves as eschatological son. And that's where he comes in, he succeeds at every point where Adam and Israel failed. Yeah. And he inherits us not merely typological blessings, but he secures for us all the things that the typological blessings pointed toward. The new heavens and the new earth, an ultimate eschatological, glorious, consummate communion and union with Christ and the new heavens and the new earth. And so that's the pattern, and it's helpful, I think. It's personally helpful for me. It clarified years ago for me some problems and inconsistencies I had with a very, continuous view of covenant theology, you know, views that you find in different quarters, which seem to downplay the differences in the Mosaic period, but yet it also doesn't divorce the Mosaic era from the period of Abraham and all the periods that came before it, as you find in classic forms of dispensationalism.
That's exactly right. See, it's a redemptive. It winds up in the pedagogy of God, Israel's theocracy, winds up being a redemptive reenactment of the sin and exile of Adam, you know, adjusted to the context of a covenant of grace, adjusted to the reality of sin, adjusted to redemptive typology, adjusted to the realm of Canaan. And so when Israel is doing this and voluntarily accepting this blood bought covenantal bond of communion, it's as redemptive as what you get in the Abrahamic.
Oh, absolutely.
But it is, nonetheless, there is going to be a sense in which when the people undertake the terms of this covenant, it will be the corporate obedience of Israel, what Klein calls their national fidelity. I'm not sure if I'm getting exactly his phrase, but Voss will call it appropriateness of expression. If that is given, it's in light of that reality that land is retained. And if that reality is missing, then the land is lost. And so I do hope the listeners will recognize that when this relationship is accepted, it is a redemptive relationship, a redemptive covenantal bond of communion that the nation as a whole is saying yes to. And it's bringing into view then the bilateral and reciprocal character that the communion bond takes.
And
Camden, I hope our listeners can appreciate this. What we just surveyed right there, which I actually wasn't planning on surveying as deeply as we did, but this is the Voss Group, I guess. But what we just surveyed there, contrast that to liberalism, to the critics.
That's what I wanted to get to, because Voss brings this up too, the critical approaches to these passages, and they're very different.
Yeah, here's what I want our listeners to remember, and this is a lesson, or kind of it's kind of got parabolic significance for our listeners. Don't get tired of interacting with liberal critics, because they are legion, and they are relentless in their attempt to desupernaturalize the scriptures and read it according to a naturalistic principle of Kantian phenomenon. And here's what he does. I'll try to do this very briefly, but he says, the moment that a critic sees the voluntariness of the union, it leads the critics to do what? First, to deny the historicity of the event. And some of our listeners and the readers of Voss might be saying, well, how does that work? Well, here's how it works. According to standard critical theories of the evolution of Israel's religion, which we've surveyed before, so I'll be brief, you move from something like primitive forms of animism, where God might be associated with inanimate objects and a spirit is present in them. It's a right. worship's directed there. You move from that to henotheism, where there is a regional parochial God greater than all to be feared. Then you move after the Israelite theocracy, really, you move toward a clear view of monotheism, that there is only one God. He's not the greatest among the gods. There is only one God. And sometime around the 7th century, years after the Exodus, as it were, you develop this higher ideal of ethical monotheism. And what is ethical monotheism? Well, it's kind of what the liberals were doing. Lo and behold, it's what the liberals were doing in the 19th and 20th century. It's a free, voluntary religion of ethical purity, where you undertake to be like Jesus as the ideal man. And mm-hmm. and you embody this free, reciprocal, voluntary religion of love. And so the critics say that if that ideal we know couldn't evolve until years past this time when on a standard dating of the Exodus is around 1480 BC, somewhere around in there, 1460, 1480. And you don't get this kind of religion developing until the time of the prophets around the 7th century, then what has happened? Here's how the critics work. Lo and behold, 7th century redactors of a prophetic school redacted older strands of tradition and imported this ideal into the Mosaic era when it just didn't exist. And I love the way Voss puts it. Why did they do this? Well, he says, since, and this is midway through page 122, since the greater impressiveness and effectiveness, it had been thought best to derive this newly produced and newly quasi-discovered law book of Moses and import it back into the Mosaic. What is he referring to? He's referring to 2 Kings 23, 1 through 3, 2 Kings 22, and the Book of the Law that was discovered under Josiah. And in that time, you get the idea of Josiah doing what? Reading the Law of the Covenant to the people, and the people saying, we will do all that is written. Yeah. So what is he saying? He's saying that the older, that what happened 8 centuries later with Josiah and the development of a prophetic school and this development of a high ethical monotheism, that gets read back.
Yeah, the ministry of truth, the Israelite yeah. ministry of truth, yeah. The new prophets decided to rewrite the history and create the Mosaic covenantal stories.
That's exactly right. They just imported their present right. into the past to forge a kind of literary connection to the past. It's like the liberal view of typology. You don't have anything in terms of a history of special revelation. So what do? You start creatively forging connections through the manipulation of a tradition. Mm-hmm. And so you import these things back and reinterpret as though it were the case when in fact it wasn't. What you get there then is the idea, instead of there being a heightening, now this is the key, instead of there being a redemptive historical heightening of a previously established communion bond, namely in the Abrahamic covenant. Instead of that being heightened and intensified, which is where we're about to go, really what you get is just an ahistorical redactive event. Yeah. It's just a later group of the prophets of Israel redacting older strands of tradition to make it cohere with what's going on in Israel at that time. And
if
and
you're so, a critic, though, and all you want is this gefühl, you know, or liberal, and you want this feeling that will make you a better person or yep. live in a way that is more noble and ethical, yep. for them it doesn't matter
exactly.
that it's supernatural or that it actually happened in history, as long as the end result, which is just bare ethicism or morality, and you feel good about it, then that's the product you want. for them on their worldview, but for us, it erodes all of reality.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's why Machen and the tradition following Machen, the Reformed tradition, has historically said that this liberalism and this critical theorizing is a different religion.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Mm-hmm. It really truly is. And Voss points out, we won't spend this much time on it, but Voss says, first of all, he says, when they're talking covenant, a lot of the critics are like dogmatic fundamentalists who think that Bereith is a synonym for compact or agreement. But even more basically, he says the narrative of 2 Kings 22 and 23:1-3 in no way clears up the origin of the covenant religion concept, because it's not a covenant between God and his people, but between the king and the people in the presence of the Lord. So he says it's not an identical or exhaustively interchangeable thing in 2 Kings 22 that you find in Exodus 24. And so, you know, the fact that the critics do this, I think our readers, particularly those who are going to go on and pursue any kind of pastoral ministry or any kind of theological training, you have to recognize that there are two principles by which you can explain Exodus 24, either an organic supernatural principle of progressive redemptive revelation, or a kind of communal redacting of an older text, trying to make it relevant to the contemporary situation, a kind of retrospective typological connection being formed by fiction.
Yeah, that's, well, certainly not typological. I don't know what it is, but yeah, it's just retrospective. It's the same kind of thing you'll find in reader response theories and different appropriations of older texts and literature. It's the same kind of thing. Well, this book means something to me, and I'm going to use it now as a motivation to, you know, go forth with whatever agenda I may have.
Exactly. And so what we say is typological. Mm-hmm. They say, it's just a redacted tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they're naturalists.
Yeah, because by nature, the typology is more than symbolism, but because it points forward.
That's exactly.
And so we have to have that. And so if there is no pointing forward in an organic way, then we've really undone everything. It's just retrospective association.
Yeah. And that is what I think is so critical for us to grasp when it comes to the different ways that the relationships between previous events in mm-hmm. Scripture and subsequent events are related. They are either related progressively and organically and supernaturally in terms of the work of God, or they're retrospectively related through the redaction of a community to aim at an ethical ideal.
Yeah.
It's just so basic. And I hope our listeners appreciate that we spend time talking about this, because it might sound abstract, might sound to some a little bit boring or too arcane to understand, but you got to recognize the enemies of the gospel, these naturalistic liberal critics, are making a cottage industry of trying to reconfigure what we call typology along these very lines, and they do it everywhere.
So if the critical tradition and the liberals have misunderstood the main point, let's reiterate what the main point is, and we can look at the last chapter of this section, the last paragraph of this section on 124, where Voss starts to introduce the idea of God revealing himself further and advancing his relationship to his people. How does this Bereith, this covenant, progress the movement of God's revelation and his communion with his people?
Well, a brief overarching thesis that Voss moves toward, he doesn't make as explicit as I think I'm going to, is this, that the events of the Exodus and the passage through the Red Sea and the event of covenant renewal in Exodus 24 are two aspects of one redemptive covenantal relationship. And remember when we talked about the Passover, we said that there was a giving of a blood sacrifice by which the people are redeemed. There's an expiatory dimension to it, followed by a fellowship or peace offering meal. So you've got
two ideas in the Israelite sacrificial system.
An expiatory dimension and a peace offering. That what's its aim? It's a fellowship meal before the Lord, a communion with the Lord, a fellowship with the Lord forged through blood sacrifice and the mighty hand of God bringing a people out of Egypt. What we have here in Exodus 24 is a formalization of what God has been doing already with his people in the Exodus out of Egypt and in the passage through the Red Sea. And so what you get is you get a sprinkling of blood, which brings into view what? Expiation and cleansing and even propitiation of divine wrath. You get the shedding of blood and the sprinkling of that blood on the people. That becomes a kind of peace offering consummated by a fellowship meal, a sacramental meal. And Voss's point is that you basically have this. You have the offering of blood and the offering of sacrifice, the sprinkling of blood and the application of that sacrifice to the people. And then you have a meal of communion with Moses and the elders with the Lord on a mountain. And what that helps us start to recognize is that you have a now national reference to Israel as a whole, implied in the summons to ascend the mountain and commune with God with 12 pillars built together with the altar, verses 1 and 4. And the point Voss is making is this, that this relationship, this covenant, is a blood relation forged redemptively that has fellowship and communion with God in an exalted place as its substance, as its focus, as its center. And he says this, and this is where I was wanting to go, and I know we've been going a long time, but I hope our readers will bear with, listeners will bear with.
No, we're right on target.
Okay, that it's in this context that verse 10 becomes so central. God is now, through this covenant, the God of Israel. Voss says that, last paragraph, highly significant. Why? And this is very important. Through the berit or berith making, Jehovah had become the God of Israel in a new, profound sense. Now, what does he mean? Well, he means this. He means that you have reached the fulfillment of a sacramental approach to God in this covenant that God has made with his people. And that means that though he was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, though he was the God of Moses, though he said to Pharaoh, "Let my people go, Israel is my firstborn son, that they may worship me, that my son may worship me," there is now a fuller and escalated and new sense in which he is the God of Israel in a blood-bought redemptive communion bond that consummates in a fellowship meal where God's sacramental presence is deeper and richer. Here's what he's saying. Here's what Voss is saying. Voss is saying this is the eschatology of the Exodus. This is a movement out of Egypt through the waters of the Red Sea and into fellowship and communion with God, sacramentally symbolized in this meal. And Camden, I wanted to do more on this, and I'll just try to keep it brief, but Meredith Klein has an essay that I found very helpful where he talks about the Book of Exodus as the foundation for the gospel genre. And one of the features, among many, that he points out is that in both the Book of Exodus and in the Gospels, you have blood being shed to inaugurate a covenant. old and new, mosaic mm-hmm. and new. You have a fellowship, sacramental meal of fellowship, Passover meal, this fellowship meal with the elders in 24. You have that in the Lord's Supper. And what you get in the Lord's Supper, particularly when you think about the implications of Pentecost, is the Lord coming to his people, Christ becoming Lord in power and glory, and coming to his people in the unbreakable and eschatological embrace of the Spirit, so that they might have a fellowship with Christ in his sufferings and in his glory, so that the new covenant further advances and eschatologically enhances this already existing bond of union and communion with the Lord. And that fellowship meal, the Lord's Supper, gives way, Revelation 19, 9 to 10, to what? The wedding supper of the Lamb, a future eschatological meal that brings into view what? Brings into view the humiliation and exaltation of the Son and the final eschatological advancement of the church into a new heavens and new earth. What Voss is getting at here is that if you do not understand Exodus 24 this way, you have fundamentally misunderstood the nature of the Mosaic covenant and the way that the eschatological movement in Exodus 24 is what is underwriting the eschatological movements in the gospel and the Lord's Supper and the resurrection and the church's fellowship with Christ and the way that is even further advanced in the wedding supper of the Lamb. And so Voss doesn't bring into view the Lord's Supper. He doesn't bring into view the wedding supper of the Lamb, but it is intrinsically appended to what Voss is getting yep. at here. And I think it's just as rich as it can be, and it will change, I think, forever. It should change the way we should read Exodus 24 mm-hmm. in relating this Mosaic covenant to the Abrahamic and to the new.
Yeah, I think that's what's so great about reading Voss. I mean, we could dip in and read four pages of him on this specific topic, but we can very quickly see how it spreads and how it interacts with and touches upon our entire reading of Scripture. And that's yes. what the beauty of what Voss is doing and why he's so beneficial and worth reading, because he is faithfully expositing and teaching us about the Scriptures.
Yes.
And what they and are.
So I hope, I know we've spent a lot of time on just a few pages each time, but I hope the listeners realize that this is just so rich and so profound that it's really worth it. And I just hope we're not going too fast.
No, I don't think we are. I don't think okay. we are. And I think we're taking our time and doing a good job. And with this medium, you know, the podcast medium, yeah. we have the freedom to do things the way we want to do them. We're yep. not beholden to time slots or commercials or the limits of, you know, the printed media or the printed page. So we're doing something unique and different, and it's fun. So thanks for joining us, Lane. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we love it. And able to continue on something that began years and years ago at Calvary OPC and with Grace Mullins. So we're thankful for your service here to keep this going and expand. We thank you so much for listening, listeners. There's so many of you out there. Our Voss group continues to get great support. I love looking at the figures and just knowing that there's so many people around the world that are listening and interested in Gerhardus Voss and Reformed theology and a redemptive historical hermeneutic. So if you're into this, tell a friend about it. You know, pass this around. I'm sure there'd be people in your churches or families or your friends who would be interested in hearing about this and following along. You can get them started in Voss Group at reformedforum.org/Voss, V-O-S, if you want to get and see all of those episodes on their own on one single page. You can certainly do that. And, of course, get a copy of Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. There are copies available at a great price at wtsbooks.com. You can visit us online at reformedforum.org. You can get a hold of us by tweeting us at Reformed Forum. You could tweet Lane at Lane Tipton.
Oh, please. I live to receive tweets.
It's his real account. It honestly is. He just doesn't tweet. No. But it's there, and he has the keys to the kingdom. So maybe if you tweet him and persuade him, maybe he'll send something out. I don't think.
Please tweet away.
Well, who knows? We certainly we'll look forward to that day, although I don't know if there's a guaranteed fulfillment to that ever coming true. But it's a possibility, a potentiality, if you will. So you can find out information about that stuff. Get a hold of us. We love hearing from you. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.